Welcome back to Open Line at WOSU 820 NPR News. I'm Fred Anderle. This hour on the program, reimagining the Christian Gospels for people of all faiths. My guest, spiritual writer Thomas More, says Jesus espoused a spiritual philosophy that has yet to be fully appreciated and understood. Thomas More says we have a tendency to sentimentalize Jesus or turn him into a moral crusader as a defense against the sheer radical challenge of his intellect. My guest seeks to present Jesus as a figure that any 21st century person could adopt as a focus for a vibrant and intelligent spiritual life. We'll find out more. Author and psychotherapist Thomas More has written numerous books on spirituality, including Care of the Soul and Life at Work. My guest's new book is Writing in the Sand. It's subtitled Jesus and the Soul of the Gospels. Welcome back to Open Line, Thomas More. Great to have you here.
Thanks, Fred.
And we're at 614-292-8513 after we lay a little groundwork here. And emails to openline@wosu.org. Tom, you say we may tend to make Jesus much less than he really was by as you say, sentimentalizing him or turning him into a moral crusader. And you think we do that as a bit of an avoidance mechanism?
Well, that's what I said there, yes. It seems to me that's one thing that may happen is that I think that the message of the Gospels and the message of Jesus is really to have a wide open heart, to be in this world in a very different way than the way you are when you're just unconscious and caught in your own narcissism. So I think that he is asking for something radical and deep and difficult. And one way, you know, to say, well, I don't think I can handle that is to keep him there, but make him tame him, you know, to make him something that is very livable and fits in with life in a very convenient way. So I think we've missed the radical nature of his teaching.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about living a life unconscious.
Well, by that I mean it's so easy to just to be in this world and to, you know, listen to the radio, watch television, read magazines, hear what's going on in the culture, and just keep taking it in and living unconsciously, just living the life that is set up for you, the values and the purposes and goals that are just there in the public domain that we pick up from the media especially. So you just go from day to day and you make your living and you just go along unconsciously. That means that you're not thinking, reflecting, and pulling out of that general philosophy that's out there. That makes us, I think, rather followers and automatons rather than people who are constantly envisioning who they are and what they have to do in this life.
Mm-hmm. If we think about the message of Jesus, and you say this is a message that anybody of any faith, or I presume of no faith, could find profitable in a spiritual sense.
Yes. What I did is look at the Gospels again. I mean, I was in a monastery years ago, and I remember when I was 19, I lived the year dedicated entirely to the spiritual life, and every morning I read the Gospels in Greek. I had studied Greek, and the Greek is not too difficult. And I read the Gospels then. Well, I haven't done that in, well, now I won't even say how many years it's been. That was a long time ago, and so I thought that maybe now is the time to go back to them and look just at the Gospels and not just think of them the way Christianity has presented them and all the habits that we have of language and thinking about them. So I wanted to look at them in a fresh way, especially in the Greek, so I could just see those words that are in the original.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I did. And what I come up with then is not an idea of this is somebody trying to make a church. You know, there's none of that I can see. He seems to be addressing the world and saying that the main thing you have to do is respect each other and create a world community. And if we could do that, our problems would be solved.
And, Tom, you use that word respect, and you use that in distinction to the word love. You don't want to use the word love here.
That's right. I translate this word agape or agape as respect. With most of these words, I look to see how they were used in the past before the Gospels were written. And that word was used sometimes to esteem something as precious, like to take something like a jewel and say this is really precious, and to feel its preciousness. So that's really kind of in the background of this word. mm-hmm. that is usually translated as love. And in the context, it seemed to me, thinking about it for a long time, that the best translation is respect, because it's not, again, a sentimental word, soft and mushy, but it is exactly what the Gospels are about, to respect people who are not of your own circle.
So if I esteem everyone as precious, in that definition of respect, mm-hmm. that means everyone I encounter, and not only everyone, but every animal and every piece yeah. of the earth, I would think,
right.
as well.
Right. Yeah. That's right. So there has to be respect. Now, I don't want to make that sound too rosy, because, you know, there's everything has its dark side, and it's not easy to respect certain people, certain people. People who are violent and aggressive, done bad things, it's very difficult. Sometimes people who are not from your circle at all, who have a very different belief system or a different culture, it's difficult to really respect. So I think it's a challenge, but the stories of the Gospels show over and over again that that's what it means to be part of this new life that was announced there. It means to respect people who are not of your circle, not of your group. And that's very different from what I think what often you see is people who gather together, people who think alike and believe alike and respect each other, and then don't really respect people outside that circle.
And it's much more difficult to do that, I would think, outside the circle. I mean, people who are a family, people who agree with us and who sort of are of our perhaps social class, it's fairly easy to do that. But when you get outside that and you find somebody very different, that's when it gets hard, I would think.
That's right. And, you know, this sentiment, this idea we're saying right now, just what you just said, is in the Gospel of Thomas. It's not in one of the New Testament Gospels, but an old and important Gospel. That point is made explicitly. So I think that really is at the heart of the teaching, that you many of the stories are about that, like the Good Samaritan would be an example, that you respect people even though there's good reason not to.
I remember hearing a friend of mine in town, a newspaper writer, said that he was driving along downtown the other day and he saw some fellow lying in the gutter, you know, and, in some distress, and he stopped his car and he pulled over. And, the police were on the scene and they were saying, this guy's really just drunk. And my friend walked over and carefully looked at him and said, no, he's not. He's not drunk. He's in some distress. He's having a medical problem. You need to call 911 and you need to get him to a hospital. And I thought that was pretty admirable, I thought, that anybody would take the time to do that.
Right.
For somebody, as we say, definitely not of his circle.
That's right. And I think this is the reason why we need spiritual practice of some kind. I don't care what it is. You need to be prepared for a situation like that. I mean, you know, unconsciously you might just be part of the crowd and just pass someone by and let someone else take care of them. But to be able to have that awareness and to respond, I think that's really what the Gospel Spirit is. And that's what that spirituality is. You know, it's not a spirituality of making yourself a better person. It's the spirituality of being in a community where you do, in fact, reach out to people.
Do we have to, do you think, you say a spiritual practice, but practice on two levels I want to ask about. Number one, do we have to practice that kind of compassion that I just talked about, the idea that we do stop and that we do pay attention and that we do respect and help that person? Is that something we need to cultivate in ourselves?
Well, yes. I don't think it's natural. That's what I mean. I think that there's a kind of a, this is what Freud said. You know, we all have a sort of a natural narcissism. He called it primary narcissism. We have this tendency to focus on ourselves and to make sure that we remain comfortable at all costs. And I think it takes some achievement, and I think it is a spiritual achievement, to be able to look beyond yourself and climb out of that narcissism and actually act on this sense that we are in it all together, that we are a community, even those people, and especially those people who don't seem to be part of our community.
So we can kind of think that through. We can think through the kinds of statements you just made and think through our relationship with others who are not of our circle, and then make a commitment to practicing respect for them.
Yes. Yes, you can make that commitment, that decision to practice that way, but of course the commitments don't always last too long. So I think it's probably more important to have your imagination really flooded with these values. That's what I think the Gospels do. I mean, they're full of stories that portrayed these values, story after story, parable after parable. And I think that's why I think reading them is really a very beneficial thing and could be part of a spiritual practice, even if you're not Christian.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't think the Gospels have to be kept within the Christian environment. You can be an agnostic or an atheist or Jewish or Buddhist or anything, and you would get a great deal from the Gospels. The trouble is they have often been presented as part of a belief system that's rather closed, and I think a lot of people feel that they shouldn't turn to them because they're really only for believers.
In fact, even some believers have, in a sense, turned away from them.
Well, they have, yeah.
Yeah, as you say, adopting new faiths or new age faiths, or they feel they didn't get much sustenance from the Gospels in many cases.
That's why I wanted to write this book. One of the reasons was that so many people have come up to me over the past few years and have said that they used to be nourished and nurtured by the Gospels, and now they miss them because they don't want to go to church anymore, or they're tired of people telling them how they should live and behave, and they're tired of sexism, all those things that people don't want from the churches today. And so I thought it would be good to present the Gospels in a way separate from that tradition, and not to be critical of the tradition, but just to separate it from them, from it, and to show that the Gospels do address a spiritual need of anybody, no matter who you are.
Author and psychotherapist Thomas Moore is with us. His new book, Writing in the Sand, Jesus and the Soul of the Gospels, 614-292-8513. Open line at WOSU.org for emails. So, Tom, we're talking about one thing, the message you get from the Gospels is respecting all, mm-hmm. especially those who are not of our circle. Another one, you say we can all be healers.
Yes.
And we can all be healers in every moment. So what kind of healing are we talking about?
That's a really good question. Okay, so I'm reading the Gospels in Greek, and I keep coming across this word therapeia in Greek, therapy. And I think, well, now he's usually translated as healing, and I think that's a fairly good translation. So Jesus is a healer, a therapist, you might say. If you just look at the Greek, that's what you're seeing, therapeia. Now, I know, having studied Greek culture a bit, I know that Plato also, the philosopher Plato, also talked a great deal about therapy. So I go back into Plato, and I read there that Socrates, his character, is asked by a student, what is therapeia? The same word used in the Gospels. What is therapeia? And Socrates says, therapeia means service. And the student says, what do you mean by service? And he says, well, it's like if you're working on a farm and you have to take care of the horses and you give them water and you clean out their stalls, that's service.
Hmm.
So he said, that's what therapy is. So it's not, I think often we think of healing as this miraculous, immediate, you know, kind of an astonishing cure of an illness. But the word has, the roots of the word are service, care, I would even say. So what you're doing is offering service to people who are suffering. I think that's really what the essence of what the word therapy means, or healing in the Gospels. So what it's asking you to do is, in every situation, and that story of your friend is I think is an example, every situation where you see suffering, you respond. That is the teaching there. Of everyone is a healer. Everyone is a healer at all times. That's how you show that you are engaged with the spirituality of the Gospels.
So I think the example I gave of my friend was a dramatic one, but just a simple example. So we're having a conversation with a coworker or with a family member, and we sense that they are in some distress about some situation in the family or at work. We could act in that sense as a healer at that point and be of service and move the conversation toward working with them to relieve their distress.
That's right, exactly. So it's a little hard to describe this. I think the picture I get when I look at the Gospels as a philosophy of life, as a spirituality, it is not you should meditate every day, not you should avoid, spending too much money or taking care of yourself too much. What you get is respond to suffering. That's what you get. I mean, that is really the major theme there. So that's really what you ought to do, is respond when you see suffering. And I think you're absolutely right. Every day, every almost, you know, many times a day, you'll be in a situation where you could act unconsciously and just dismiss someone or get into an argument, whatever. But if you could see the suffering, perceive the suffering, and respond, in service to that, then I think that's really living the gospel story.
I think you could do that in very brief situations, I would think, too. Let's say you're at a store and you notice that the clerk who is checking you out is looking rather grim. I mean, I've seen some people walk up to a person like that and just give them a smile, mm-hmm. and just say a light word. And sometimes you see the person, at least for that moment, transformed.
That's right. Absolutely. I notice this when I travel. I was just writing about this yesterday. I get into an elevator, and it's a nice custom I find all over the world that, you know, you're tired out and you've been traveling and you're away from home, and it's kind of a custom that you're on an elevator. Someone always says when they're leaving you, especially at night, you know, take it easy. Hope you had a great day. Those things, that kind of friendliness may seem superficial. I don't think it is. I think that responding to need wherever you see it is in the spirit of the Gospels, and it's with you all the time, and it doesn't have to be profound and deep in every instance. It just could be the everyday encounters we have.
We had I used to work at a radio station downtown here that was in, local listeners will know, the Buckeye Federal Building, and at that time there was an elevator operator in the elevator, right, taking us up 15 floors. And people would get on the elevator, and it was a wonderful time on that elevator, because he would know your name, he would greet you, he would ask you how you're doing, and then he'd tell you jokes.
Right.
And he'd get everybody in the elevator involved in his stories, and you came out of that elevator, you know, a minute later or 2 minutes later, in a much better mood, and everybody looked forward to riding up in that elevator or riding down in the afternoon with that guy, and he transformed the place.
I'd call him a therapist. In the gospel sense, yeah, or in the ordinary sense. No, I practice psychotherapy, and so when I see the word therapy in the Gospels, I often think of my profession too. I mean, I've studied psychotherapy and have practiced it for many years, and one of the things I know that I do as a therapist, people come to me, and the things they tell me, if they said those things outside of therapy, someone might get into a fight with them or argue or try to tell them to change or whatever. But as a therapist, I know it's going to do no good to argue. It's not my role, or even to give advice. My role is to serve that person there and to explore what's going on with them and to bring them to a point where their anger might come up and they can see what they're angry about or whatever has to be done. That is serving their suffering. I would say serving their soul. So I think that's really what the Gospels are about, too, is that instead of the unconscious reaction of just taking care of yourself and being disturbed, instead of that, you can be the therapist in the moment and guide a person towards some relief or some understanding.
Tell me, do we, in reading the Gospels, do we see those kinds of incidents in the life of Jesus?
I think we see them all the time. He is very, very aware of people in their suffering. One common example, and it's often taken very literally, but the Gospels themselves don't take it literally. He heals the blind. Now, the story could be taken literally and saying he's going around making, you know, people who can't see. But the stories, even in the Gospels, they say, well, this is a person who didn't understand what was going on, and now he sees. He sees himself. He sees his life for what it is. So I think that's really what it means to cure the blind. You know, you meet somebody who's got a blindness, you know, who just can't see what's happening, what's going on, and so his life is miserable. So if there's some way that you can offer a little bit of enlightenment, be the therapist in the moment, offer some companionship and maybe a little insight, that is doing exactly what Jesus shows in the Gospels.
Mm-hmm. Tom, I'm very interested in one thing. One sentence in the book, you say, Jesus' message to humankind was, look at the world anew and find heaven on earth. Tell me about that, finding heaven on earth.
Well, that's interesting. Heaven's an interesting word. The word for heaven is, I don't want to get too technical here, but the word for heaven in Greek is ouranos. That was the name of one of the the gods of the Greeks. The sky father of the Greeks was called Uranos. And you find that word whenever they talk about heaven, the kingdom of heaven, the word is Uranos. So it's like a sky image. It's like imagining almost utopia. It's like saying, well, heaven on earth is like, it's trying to establish this kind of a community on earth where people do care for each other and don't react blindly out of their complexes and out of their frustrations and anger, but actually can be of service to each other. Now, that seems impossible, but it is a sort of sky image. It's like it's way off in the distance. It seems to be way up there in the ethers. But the idea would be to try to bring that philosophy down to earth and actually live it. So that's heaven on earth. I think that's really what the Gospels are about. That's what the word kingdom means. We talk about the kingdom of heaven. It's the kingdom of Uranos, the kingdom of the sky, which is ideal, but you do everything possible to make that ideal present in your ordinary life.
It does seem almost impossible, I mean, on the massive scale, doesn't it? Because, I mean, warfare everywhere. People killing one another, killing innocents at the extreme and in personal lives, as you say, our unconscious default mechanism is to look out after our own interests.
Well, that's true. But then there's another dimension of it, too, that has to do with these Gospels, and that is that religion is often presented so literally, so moralistically. You know, you should do this and do that, that you really don't get a vision. So people who are have a particular viewpoint because of their religion feel that they are not part of the world, that they are in this defensive camp, and they're the only believers. And we see so much violence in the world based on that kind of a religious self-protection. So one of the things I'm trying to do with the Gospels is to say that there's absolutely no need to read them in that way. There's an intelligence there that we have missed. It's not about protecting your own group in your own community of believers, and it's not about feeling yourself chosen and separate from everyone else. It's about being part of the world and, in fact, developing a philosophy which is also a psychology, because there's a lot of psychological work that goes into dealing with that narcissism. In other words, to live the gospel spirituality, you have to do a lot of psychological work as well to be able to deal with habits and with frustrations that are long-lasting. You have to deal with your emotions.
Do you think, and we have to become aware of them, in other words, we have to, in a sense, examine our emotions? Do we think about what we are experiencing rather than, I guess you'd say, blindly or unconsciously following them?
Yes. I mean, one simple way that the therapists know that you can deal with emotions that constantly get in the way is to trace their roots. That means just telling the story. So you have this feeling that you might say that whenever you are in a situation with a competitor, you just feel angry and you just want to, you know, blast the other person. Well, then you might start at that point and go back and track the stories of similar situations. That's one of the things therapists do. Now, they may think they're looking for an explanation. I think what they're doing is looking for the narratives, the stories, the patterns that are at work in a person's life. And as you become more aware of those patterns, you can get some relief from them. They don't dominate you as much. So there are ways of dealing with these emotional blocks that prevent you from being part of the world community. It takes some time, but it can be done.
My guest, author and psychotherapist Thomas Moore, his new book, Writing in the Sand, Jesus and the Soul of the Gospels. We're going to be right back after these messages at WOSU 820 NPR News.
WOSU News reports on stories from around the state and in your backyard.
Representatives Kilroy and Space both say they have not yet taken a position on the climate change bill.
Well, I want to see what the final bill looks like.
Look, I'm trying not to approach this from a political perspective. I'm trying to approach it from the perspective of doing the right thing.
Get more from your news with the award-winning WOSU News Team on WOSU 89.7 FM, NPR News, and classical music.
Good morning, and thanks for joining us for Open Line this morning. It's currently 70 degrees in downtown Columbus. At noon, fresh air will be here. According to Scott McCartney, the outlook for summer travel is smoother and cheaper than in recent years. McCartney follows the airline industry and writes the weekly column The Middle Seat for the Wall Street Journal. He'll talk about taking summer trips for less on Fresh Air beginning at noon, right here on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Support for WOSU comes from the Columbus Metropolitan Club, presenting a variety of speakers on the relevant issues of today. More information is available at www.columbusmetroclub.org.
Taking a look at the weather forecast, some sunshine today, but a good chance of showers and thunderstorms throughout the day, a high right around 78. Cloudy tonight with rain showers and thunderstorms likely this evening, and then skies will clear throughout the night and a low of 55. Some sunshine for Friday and a high of 78. Currently 71 degrees in downtown Columbus. And now back to Open Line.
Welcome back to Open Line at WOSU 820 NPR News. I'm Fred Anderle, this hour reinterpreting the Christian Gospels for people of all faiths. My guest, spiritual writer Thomas Moore, says Jesus espoused a spiritual philosophy that has yet to be fully appreciated and understood. In fact, Thomas Moore says we have a tendency to sentimentalize Jesus or turn him into a moral crusader as a defense against the sheer radical challenge of his intellect. And Tom seeks to present Jesus as a figure that any 21st century person, of faith or not of faith, could adopt as a focus for a vibrant and intelligent spiritual life. Thomas Moore's new book, Writing in the Sand, Jesus and the Soul of the Gospels. If any of this sounds familiar or appropriate or interesting, do join our conversation at 614-292-8513. You can email comments or questions to openline@wosu.org. Tom, we have spiritual practices like meditation or contemplative prayer in just about every spiritual tradition, I think, and even in non-spiritual traditions. So tell me about some of those practices that you think might be valuable in cultivating the kind of attitude of respect we talk about, the kind of attitude of healing that we talked about.
One thing I used to do as part of my life when I was in a monastery was what we called spiritual reading. And this is what got me to writing this book. So there's a way to read that is meditative and reflective, and it's not just for information. So I think that's an interesting thing to do, to develop this the spirit here. So I would suggest, actually, a practice of reading these Gospels. Now, you have to be careful. One of the things I've done in writing this book is retranslate a lot of the passages. There are a lot of problems in translation, so much so that yesterday, I started, I don't know if I'm going to do it, but started the idea of writing my own translation of the gospel. Because can I give you an example?
Sure.
A word that a lot of people know who are familiar with this tradition is metanoia. And this word is in Greek has been used by a lot of teachers and preachers. And they often translate it as repentance. And in fact, every Bible I looked at, even the rather recent ones, translate it as repentance. Now, that's a kind of a moral word, repent. Mm-hmm. Repent for your mistakes. And it can induce guilt, and it makes you think morally about the whole gospel message. Now, the word metanoia, noia is the word in there. It means mind, or it means the order of the world. It means intelligence, the way you understand things. Meta means to change, or means after. So metanoia as a word means more to shift the way you see things, make a shift in the way you understand the world. It's not really repentance. Now, I looked in the dictionaries, the Greek dictionaries, and it says the word means to shift your mindset, but in the New Testament it means repentance. That's what the dictionary said. It's like mm-hmm. the dictionary picks up this traditional meaning of repentance. So what I do is go through the Gospels and take words like that and reconsider them, not just to make up my own meanings, but to try to see what the words really mean in a deeper way. And you get a less of a moral attitude than in the Gospels. It's closer to Zen. In fact, If metanoia means to shift in the way you see the world, that's exactly the way I have seen the Zen word Satori defined, a shift in the way you see your world. So in that way, then, Satori and metanoia are very, very similar, if not the same. So that's an interesting thing, to be able to read the Gospels thoughtfully and reflectively. But the problem is you really need a good translation.
Uh-huh.
So I would suggest more recent translations. Usually they're a little bit better. But to read reflectively, I think, is a wonderful form of meditation in relation to this material in particular.
All right. Let us go to our callers and emailers. And Scott is on the line. Hello, Scott.
Where can I get more information on your studies? Do you have a website or a book or what? Where can I find a little bit more? Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Sure, I have a website. It's called careofthesoul.net, careofthesoul.net, not .com, .net.
Mm-hmm.
There's also a blog, thomasmoore.ning.com, that has information and has a lot of my essays on it. And for books, probably the best thing to do would be to look at Care of the Soul, which was published 15 years ago now, but still has the basics of what I do.
Mm-hmm. Okay,
thanks.
Scott?
Thanks, Fred.
Sure thing. Thanks. 614-292-8513. Through email from Andrew here. Andrew says, he asks, hasn't Christianity been hijacked and used to make millions and millions of dollars and to create fame and power for a few people who claim to be, quote, Jesus-like or Christians, yet they're into power and fame? And he lists a few names that come to Andrew's mind. He says Pat Robertson, Rod Parsley. He suggests Tim Lander, Oral Roberts. Those are his choices. Is it like a family business? What would Jesus say? Asks Andrew.
Well, I really don't like to be in the business of judging other people's approaches. I really don't. I think probably in their own way, so many people, yes, they're making a lot of money. I wouldn't mind making a little money on my books, I have to say, you know, to pay for my college tuition for my daughter and things like that. So it's not a terrible thing. But I do agree, though, with the implication there that the Gospels have been taken off in a direction that has not been very good. It has been more self-serving than it should be. So, yeah, I think they need to be read freshly. That's why I wrote this book. And they need to be read as intelligent things, not just naive. So often people take the Gospels and just think, what nice little stories. I used to read the parables and think that they were little stories about how you can live and be a good person and, you know, live a nice life. Now I think they're radical statements that say, you need to shift basically in the way you see the world. You may have to quit your job, you know, if you want to follow this through. You may have to do things that you never thought you'd have to do in order to really live this philosophy. So I think it's much more radical and challenging than I ever thought it was before.
Tom, you say a shift in the way we see the world, and we mentioned the idea of respecting all humans and all beings, even those who are not of your circle. Mm-hmm. We talked about being a healer in every situation, attempting to relieve suffering in other situations, mm-hmm. in every situation. Another way of shifting our mind, you point out, and you see this in the Christian Gospels, is you say you do everything possible to deal with demonic urges in yourself and in society. So let's talk about the word demonic and what those urges might be.
Sure. This is another example where I think the translations have misled us. Usually you talk about casting out demons. But if you look at that, if you look at the whole the gospel stories, I think it'd be better to say, and this is the way I translate it, is that you get rid of the demonic urges that are within you and your society. The word in Greek, if I can go back to the Greek without being too technical, is daimon. It's not demon, daimon, which is very similar to what contemporary psychologists refer to as a complex. It means that all of us have urges, very powerful urges sometimes, like an urge toward jealousy or toward greed or toward envy, prejudice, all these sorts of things. These are the demonic urges within us, daimonic, these things that we can't control very well and cause a lot of people to be violent. I mean, look at the papers these days, and just in the past few weeks, see how many people have been murdered because of jealousy. I mean, just amazing. Well, that's a daimonic urge. That's really a strong complex. It just takes over a person, and they get violent through it. We can apply that then to the international scene. We have, you know, terrible demonic forces at loose in the world now. So I think the gospel is saying, look, part of this process, if you want to follow this way of life and really establish a real community, you have to deal with those urges, those demonic urges within you. You have to face them, face up to them, and do something about them, and just don't let them continue day after day.
Tom, when you say deal with them and face up with to them, can you give me an example of how you might deal with an urge toward jealousy or anger?
Yes, I think well, first of all, I can tell you how not to deal with it, is to just be jealous and just say, well, there I am, I'm jealous, and just act on it and never think about it. Never face yourself and say, you know, I'm really the jealous person here. So many people who are jealous take their jealousy literally. That is, they just assume that all their thoughts are accurate, that all their suspicions about their spouse or whoever it is, their lover that they're worried about are simply true. They never stop to say, "This is my jealousy. Why would I be so jealous? What is it about me that I'm so jealous?" Now, if that person's in therapy, what I do is try to help them confront themselves and say, "Well, you know, this jealousy is yours. Let's stop blaming the other person. Let's look at yourself. Do you have any reason in your past, for example, to suspect why you might be such a jealous person? Or what is it that you're afraid of? What makes you so upset?" These are things that that deal with the demonic eventually. You can get through jealousy, and you can get through all these other complexes, these urges. But it takes strength and courage to be able to do it, to face up to it, to admit to what's going on in yourself. So I think that's really behind the gospel story there. And this is, by the way, is presented as one of the basic things to do, right along with healing and respect. It's deal with the demonic. Think of all the other possible things that Jesus could be saying you should do. This is one of the things that he presents. So I think it's key, and it's a very important thing.
I wonder if in our culture, you know, I think about maybe we could call this in a certain sense emotional intelligence. And I wonder if in our schools, for example, that many of us are not given the tools, I mean the therapeutic tools in a way for ourselves to understand how to approach something like jealousy or anger and how to deal with that productively.
Oh, I'm with you there all the way, Fred, because I have been urging so long that we bring some kind of a broader sense of what education means to our schools. We should be learning the basics of relationship, of getting along with each other, the basics of dealing with these complexes that affect everybody. This kind of basic psychology, kind of a very practical, personal psychotherapy, is easy to learn. You know, there's not a whole lot there. It's not as complicated as people make it out to be. And I wish that we could bring that into our schools, because the alternative is what we have. People leave school and they've never learned anything about dealing with their emotions.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, we have all these problems with marriage, and we have violence everywhere.
You do see some programs, I think, in some schools on nonviolent conflict resolution.
Yes.
One would like to see it taken a lot farther than that.
One would like to see it go farther and start at the beginning and really help kids as they go through school to deal with their conflicts as they go, conflicts among themselves and also with authorities and with their parents.
Author and psychotherapist Thomas Moore, Writing in the Sand, is my guest's new book, Writing in the Sand. It is subtitled Jesus and the Soul of the Gospels. It's about reinterpreting the Christian Gospels for people of all faiths and, for that matter, people of no faith. We're at 614-292-8513. If you'd like to join the conversation on the air, emails to openline@wosu.org. Tom, we have an email from Karen. Karen asks, can we derive the same spiritual lessons and examples from the Gnostic Gospels as we can from those Gospels contained in the Bible? Tell, and when you answer, Tom, tell us a little about what a Gnostic Gospel is.
Well, first of all, there were many Gospels written shortly after the time of Christ. So shortly, I mean, like within 200 or 300 years, many Gospels written. Only four were considered official. That was decided like 400 or 500 years later, that only four Gospels would be the official ones to be included in the New Testament. So there are a lot of other Gospels. They're very interesting and fascinating. I really suggest reading them, and you get a lot of spiritual inspiration and ideas from them, more so maybe than you would get just by reading the New Testament Gospels. Some of those other Gospels are Gnostic Gospels, not all of them. Some are Gnostic. That means there's a great deal of the controversy about what Gnostic means, but there is a philosophy very current before and after the time of Christ called Gnosticism that is very hard to describe, but it usually involved a mythology of figures in the heavens and the descent of the soul into human life and all the things going on there. It's complex, but very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I'll give you an example I mentioned in my book. The Gospel of Judas was published this year, or in the past couple of years. Very interesting gospel about Judas. And in one little passage, Judas says to Jesus, "I know who you are," he says. "You are from the immortal realm of Barbello." Now, you probably never would hear that in church because that's not in the New Testament. But Barbella was one of these Gnostic names given to the mother of being, the mother of all that exists. And he's saying that Jesus came directly from this mother of all things, the mother of all being. Well, that's really fascinating to meditate on. If you're thinking about the Gospels and Jesus, that there's a deep maternal source right next to and behind Jesus. And then you read the Gospels and read so much about Mary, his mother, and you wonder, because when you read about spiritual teachers, you don't often hear so much about the mother. But there it is, Jesus and mother together. So that creates a very soulful environment for what happens in his life and work. So that's an example of what you might be able to pick up from one of the Gnostic Gospels. But I'm telling you, you have to do a lot of reading and research. They're not easy to read.
Sure. You say the Gospel of Judas. Is that the Judas, a familiar of the Old Testament, who betrayed Jesus?
The New Testament, yes, who betrayed Jesus.
Theoretically authored by him?
Theoretically, but you know, the author's names are not the same as we have today. We know who our authors are. In those days, you'd pick a big name for a book if you wanted people to read it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let us go to Kevin. Hello, Kevin. You're on the air.
Hi, Fred. Thank you for your service and therapy for Columbus. My question is for Dr. Moran, that what is a reinterpretation of the Gospels in this way, this more spiritualized way, as opposed to maybe perhaps a religious way? How does that affect the notion of prayer, and how does Dr. Moore see a change in a person's prayerful life given the reinterpretation?
Thank you. That's a wonderful question. I don't think there's a major difference, but I think there's an intensification, because one of the things that I see in the Gospels and I write about here is that Jesus has two dimensions that are very intense. One is that he's very, very earthy. And he loves to eat and cooks, and he's even in one of his Gospels, he dances with his friends. And so he's a very earthy person. He wants children around. He has men and women around him all the time. His first miracle, his first act as a spiritual teacher takes place at a wedding party. He's a very, very, you know, earthy person. On the other hand, he's extremely spiritual and models how to pray. He always prays. He's always in relationship to his Father, the Father Spirit, that Uranus Spirit I was talking about, the sky spirit. So I think what we get then, the kind of prayer that you'd find from the Gospels then, is an intense prayer to the Father Spirit. The Our Father would be a good prayer to say and to meditate on. On the other hand, it's always done in relationship to this very earthy life. And in fact, Jesus often turns to prayer when he is feeling most depressed or anxious or troubled. That's when he often turns to the Father in prayer. So I think that's a model for us, that when we are going through a lot of struggle, emotional struggle, that that we connect our prayer to that emotional struggle, that we always try to keep heaven and earth together, the sky, spirituality, always connected to our earthy way of life.
Okay, Kevin?
Yeah, well, I think that I was just going to say, I think that that might be the key. The prayerfulness may be the key to changing the way that we actually change our way of thinking. That it is sort of the key. I think it's a forgotten key as to how a person might change his or her vision of life and see the world anew and see it differently in that Satori or that Zen way, that prayer may be a far greater key to doing that than has otherwise been accepted or seen.
I agree with you completely. We'd have to have a long conversation about it, though.
Well, thanks very much for your answer.
Kevin, thanks so much. Tom, you write in Writing in the Sand, you say, I'm suggesting that the very heart of Jesus' teaching and the primary way of realizing his kingdom is the gathering of people over food. Tell us more about that.
Well, we see this over and over again with Jesus. I call him an Epicurean. Because an Epicurean means someone who loves ordinary deep pleasures, like friendship, gathering people together to dine, to food, to have dinner parties and enjoying conversation. We see this in the Gospels. There's even one passage, you know, when Jesus has, after his death, and we see him in a resurrected form, and his friends are out there in the boat, and they say, is that Jesus on the shore? And someone says, yes, he's cooking. You know, he's cooking fish there on the shore. The big image we have of him, the main image we have of him is the Last Supper, where he's eating. The first miracle, as I said, is he's at a wedding party and he makes wine. So there is something about food that is very, very important to the soul. That's why I call this book the Soul of the Gospels instead of the Spirit of the Gospels. The soul means the deep human dimension, the thing that makes us human, the deep pleasures that make life worthwhile, and gathering people together around food is the way Jesus shows to create community. So it's not an abstract ideal saying, wouldn't it be great if the whole world were just a community? Instead, he says, eat with your friends, hang out with your friends and eat with them. Better yet, cook for your friends, and that's a way to create community.
So community is very important.
Yes, it's about community, I think, yes.
Mm-hmm. All right, is there a difference between soul and spirit?
Yes. This is a very old tradition, that the soul, the way I use the word soul, it's this deep soul, it's the soul that is takes us to our depths, our deep feelings, our deep thoughts, our ordinary lives, the deep pleasures that we have, the simple pleasures, which in tradition are mainly friendship and family, children, and dining together. And so that's the realm of soul, our attachments, being in a place and loving our place, the simple things that are so important to us, objects that we own that are so important to us, being attached to them. The other dimension, which is complementary but different, is the spirit, which is more detachment. It's more about moving away from family, away from home, exploring the world, meditating in a very ethereal, distant way, moving into the future. That's the spiritual life. Prayer, that's the spiritual life. Mm-hmm. So these two are very distinct, but they belong together, and so we need both of them, spirit and soul. But I think that usually when we talk about Jesus, we think of his spiritual side, and I wanted to emphasize the soul dimension.
All right. Let us go to our callers. Armar, am I pronouncing your name correctly? Hi.
Hey, how you doing? Fred, thank you so much for all these wonderful years, and I really enjoy your show.
Thank you.
One thing that I really wanted to ask your guest is that I wanted to, I really have a difficult believing that a large group of a Christian in our population take the gospel very serious, especially the conservative, part of the population, because there's a lot of contradiction of Jesus' work, like supporting the poor, being nonviolent. That's very serious work of Jesus, and you know that Jesus has always been loving, and in every encounter that he encountered with people, he was very humble and serving.
Sure. People. So running out of time, did you have a specific question then?
So my question is, do a lot of these people not take the gospel very serious because they always do, or most part of in their policies, opposite of what Jesus would have done?
All right, let's ask that question. Tom?
Yes, I think that we have missed the boat on the Gospels. They have been presented so moralistically, telling people, you know, how you should live and taking them word for word, saying this is the word, rather than really getting into the depth of the stories and the parables. So I think we've not been deep enough in our understanding of the Gospels. We have translated them into moral categories, which have to do then with guilt and people really feeling bad about themselves, and that's not a good place to start in creating community. So that's why I wrote this book. I'm trying to add to the movement to take the Gospels into a different territory, so that we can return to this notion of Jesus, as you say, as this person who is nonviolent and kind and can knows how to be both spiritual and very human at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, caller. We have time for a quick question from Chris. Hi, Chris.
Hi, it's very much an honor to speak with both of you, especially you, Thomas Moore. I've read your books. I'm in a 12-step program, and we very much support what you do. My question is, what would be the best Bible translation to read?
I wish I could tell you. I'm sorry, I don't know. That's why I wanted to work on one myself. I don't know what's out there. I should do this research to be able to answer your question. And I haven't. So you'll have to go to a bookstore or librarian and ask for one of the more recent translations and see if you can find one that, and look over a familiar passage, see how it's translated. But I'm sorry, I can't answer your question right
and
now.
I would also like to know what you think about the Eucharist.
Well, we have just about 1 minute.
1 minute, okay. 30
tough.
Seconds for
That's
that.
Tough.
The Eucharist is a symbolic ritual enactment of the Last Supper. So the more it's done in the style of a supper and the sense of the earthy sense of people gathering together, I think the more it's in the spirit. We need to bring the soul back into the Eucharist and not just the spirit. But I must take the last 30 seconds to say, Fred, thank you for having me on this this last week of your work, and it's been such a wonderful experience for me to work with you, and I wish you all the luck in whatever comes to you next.
Thomas, it's been wonderful having you on the show over the years, and I thought this is an especially, you're my last guest, because tomorrow we have a 2-hour open forum, open phones, and everybody can call in and we'll talk about issues and say goodbye. So I thought you would be a wonderful final guest to have here on the show. It's my honor to have you here on the show, and it's just been great working with you all these years.
Well, it's my honor, Fred. And I know everyone loves you and loves your work, so it's just been a wonderful pleasure, and it's an enactment of what we've been talking about today for me.
Oh, thanks so much. Thomas Moore, Writing in the Sand, Jesus and the Soul of the Gospels. I want to thank Amy Jurovich, our line producer, our producer Linda Taylor, Renee Bamba on the phones, and Brian Scullin, our production assistant. Terry Gross is next on listener-supported WOSU and WOSU HD 820 Columbus, streaming on the web.